can now hear you.
Good morning, good afternoon to those of you in Europe. On behalf of Niagara Capital Partners and Friedberg Mercantile Group, welcome to the Niagara Friedberg Conference Call Facility. I'm David Rothberg, Chairman of Niagara Capital. Niagara Capital is the administrative manager of the Niagara Friedberg Global Macro Hedge Fund and the Niagara Legacy Fund, both feeder funds into the Friedberg Global Macro Hedge Fund and of the Niagara Discovery Fund, which is a CTA-based global macro fund. With me is Albert Friedberg, founder of Friedberg Mercantile Group and portfolio manager of the Friedberg Global Macro Hedge Fund. The fund started in 2001 with the objective of preserving capital and generating positive returns on a rolling 12-month basis. As those of you who are our clients know, the fund has done well since inception. We've been particularly fortunate during these past very dramatic 15 months. The purpose of today's call is to make known Al's views on the investment landscape. The format for today's call is going to work like this. I'm going to act as an interlocutor, putting to Al a number of questions I assume that you, our audience, would ask, and then we're going to turn the discussion public. The public discussion we will hold by answering questions put to us by email. I'm afraid you will not be able to put questions to Al over the phone. If you have questions, please email them now to erot@niagaracapital.ca. I repeat, erot, E-R-O-T-T, at niagaracapital.ca. One final bit of housekeeping to get out of the way before we begin. In the event that you can't stay with us for the duration of the call, I remind you that a transcript will be posted on our website in real audio format. Okay, let's begin, shall we? Al, welcome.
Good morning, good morning. Good morning, good afternoon.
Let's cut right to the chase. Have we suffered enough? Has the current decline discounted all the plagues? Or does the obscurity of the derivative markets, the length of the bull market that preceded this cataclysm, the enormity of the debt that was assumed over the same period, and we could probably name many, many more, do all of these factors mean that markets are headed lower still?
No. I don't believe so. I believe that the financial markets have already discounted what probably will be the worst recession in the post-war, or probably as bad as the 1974 recession. I believe the financial markets have discounted either all of it or most of it. And I think that we are now past the point of maximum pain, and we should be well on the way up from here.
Is this because of? Is this entirely a result of the policy response?
Yeah, I think that that's true. The policy response, which at first was very tepid and very poor in some way, because the policymakers did not anticipate the problems, began to gain strength over the past 2 months. And in particular, not so much the fiscal moves, but the monetary moves were extremely dramatic. In the past 45 days, the Federal Reserve balance sheet has expanded by almost $2 trillion, which is an enormous expansion. The Fed is discounting almost any kind of paper, any kind of good paper that banks will advance to it. The Fed has got an open window, literally an open window. It is now buying commercial paper from non-financial institutions. Most interestingly, the Fed has a mechanism by which it can retain this extraordinary expansion of reserves. The Fed is paying interest to banks for their excess reserves, and thus allowing them to feel more comfortable with the reserves, but at the same time, in a way, capturing those reserves so that they don't necessarily leak out and become a major force in money supply expansion. I believe that this will become a problem, and we can talk about it a little later in this talk. But for now, the combined action of the that we have going forward is that we may have overdone it. And we will be overdoing it, there's no question about it, because more fiscal moves are on the way, and especially with the new administration. And I believe that we will be hitting the economy with more fiscal stimulus at a point at which the economy would probably be already touching bottom. So my scenario is that the economy will still move down quickly here, still accelerating downward. Unemployment rates will likely reach somewhere between 8.5% and 9%. Industrial production will be sharply lower. It's a foregone conclusion that the fourth quarter will be down substantially, maybe 3%, and perhaps the first quarter of next year will be down also substantially. But that the market will find, the economy will find some bottom somewhere in spring, and at which point it will begin a recovery. Again, the danger is that we're overdoing we're overdoing with counter-cyclical moves, and that we will end up with a much bigger problem towards the end of the year, maybe next year, maybe in 2010, but maybe even late 2009, where we're going to end up with an overly stimulated economy from a monetary point of view, and some serious inflationary problems. Just to summarize it then, the economy is still very weak and getting weaker. The financial markets, however, being discount mechanisms, already on the way up.
So, is your view then that the market is in the process of making a bottom at current levels? Groping to find the bottom at current levels?
Unequivocally, yes. If we haven't already made a bottom, we are in the process of making a bottom. And when I say financial markets, we have to be careful. What do we mean by financial markets?
Yes.
Clearly, the U.S. equity market. Most probably, the developed markets, the European markets. Not so clearly and not so sure that that's the case with the emerging markets. And even there, we may have different levels. I mean, we may have the economy there. Some emerging markets may recover together with the developing markets, and some may not. As the economic contraction gains strength, there will be areas in the world that will suffer huge capital outflows, like Central European countries. And it's not clear that countries like Russia, for instance, would be able to withstand the outflows. And so we can't really make a judgment about those markets. But the larger, more liquid markets, and in particular the U.S., equity markets should do well. The bond markets, again, it will be stratified. The blue chip, that's called the single A and up bonds, will improve significantly in the next few months, and then slowly we'll start getting an improvement in the double B area, and then in the junk area at some point. The reason why junk may not move immediately higher is because we still have not had the default rate that the market is already anticipating. But we will start getting a large increase in the default rate, and then that will also, at that point, the market will begin to react better. So it's a funny thing, because you got to look at this as a contrast. It's a continuous contrast. The market does very well end of 06 and beginning of 07. I'm concerned about what is already happening that will, the shadows that we are casting already in late 06 and 07. And I'm concerned about this bubble, this credit bubble. And the market just keeps going higher. By the seeds of destruction were already planted then, in 06 and through 06 and early 07. And so the market moves up. And now the market begins to move down when we don't see almost anything. And if you recall the comments and the press and the media, that this was a subprime problem only, that this was contained, that this was a $50 billion problem and then became a $200 billion problem, and that nothing is really happening to the economy and that the earnings are still good. So the market, again, in a study of contrast, the market was saying, well, this is not really too bad. So, but yet it was starting to discount what was about to happen. And so now the bad news are coming out, and they're coming out and getting increasingly so. The market now will begin to feel better because it has, in fact, discounted the events. However, had there been no intervention, it is likely that we would have gone down a great deal more because the decline would have been extreme.
Yeah, I'd like to circle back to the discussion that we broached about the policy response. There's been an enormous increase in the monetary base, and reserve growth is large. I sense that your feeling about this is that looking over the Gulf, we are going to. This money is going to result in accelerating inflation. Currently, David Rosenberg of Merrill Lynch, whose voice has been very true throughout this crisis, claims that deflation is the issue that the economy faces. What's your view on that?
Okay, we have to be careful in definitions here. The what is deflation and what is inflation? Both of those phenomena are monetary phenomena. When you say that we are in a deflation, it means we are in a persistent state of falling prices, and that is usually due to a monetary contraction. When you are in inflation, it means that you are in a state of rising prices and sometimes accelerating prices. And that again is due to a monetary phenomena of money that's increasing far faster. The supply of money is increasing far faster than production. When David Rosenberg, who is great, and I really think that he's called very well most of these events. When he speaks about deflation, and generally when the market speaks about deflation, they're speaking about they're not speaking about the same kind of deflation that we're talking about. They're speaking about momentary declines in, for instance, commodity prices, where you have a large drop in the price of oil, which means a large drop in gasoline, which means that it's going to affect substantially the way we measure consumer prices, so that we're going to have a negative consumer price for 1 month and maybe zero or negative consumer prices for the next few months because that's how we measure it. These are events, let's say, events that take place that do not have a persistence to them, do not have a kind of a trend to them. Because soon enough, when the price of gasoline is back to $2 a gallon, and now it's about $2.30 or so, I'm not implying a forecast, but when gasoline reaches a certain level, it no longer influences consumer prices. And so what you have then is the underlying trend of inflation, which is we call it core or underlying inflation, and that at the moment is still something in the area of 2-3% a year. So it's being masked by events, like dramatic events, like the drop in the price of gasoline. That's what the market means when the market says deflation. There is deflation because we have commodity prices drop, because we have production, and because we have inventory sales, because we have people dumping goods that they produced in anticipation of selling them, and they're not selling them. But these are monetary events. Once those things are out of the way, once the glut has been taken care of, the underlying trend of inflation reasserts itself, and that is dictated by monetary factors. So if you ask me, is there going to be deflation or is there going to be inflation, I say to you, the numbers will show in the next few months a very low rate of inflation, or maybe even a deflation for the next 3 or 4 months. But that does not mean that it's not going to be inflation. The underlying trend is still for much higher prices, and especially now when we have this phenomenal expansion of Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve balance sheet. As you mentioned, the monetary base has exploded upwards. And if the monetary base continues to maintain its normal relationship to world monetary aggregates, and it does, when the banking system is not broken completely, like it was in Japan, when it's not broken completely, there is a mechanism by which this monetary base will translate into an acceleration of money. So therefore, because we define inflation as a growth of money in excess of production and an acceleration of the growth of money, because of that, I believe that we're going to have a serious inflation problem sometime next year. And that we are definitely not in a deflation at the moment. Nor are we likely to be in a deflation again, I think, in history, because we learned the last time there was a deflation was in 1937, and that was the result of money contracting, money supply contracting. And I don't think that anybody today will allow the money supply to contract.
What will the investment horizon look like then when the effects of monetary growth are felt and we start to see rising inflation? Are we going to see a series of rolling bubbles like we saw in 2006? Will this be a strong environment for stocks? Will it be a strong environment for gold?
Yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. You got to look at the most, when you study bubbles and you study inflation, you have to look at different sectors and see how they react. For instance, commodity prices are extremely sensitive, very, very sensitive to inflationary forces. Most likely thing is that commodity prices will react upwards quickly at the first whiffs of a business turnaround. In other words, as the economy hits bottom and begins to recover very slowly, and this tidal wave of money hits the economy, commodity prices are likely to be one of the first to go up. Another very sensitive, very, very sensitive, another very sensitive factor is for instance, the currency, the dollar. If the U.S. is inflating more rapidly than other countries, then the effect will be a falling dollar, and that will happen very quickly, because that market too is very sensitive. There are other elements that move much more slowly than currency and commodities. For instance, consumer prices in general, you know, they have a certain kind of a slow move. Rents don't move up very quickly and they're not very sensitive. Wages don't move up very quickly and they're not very sensitive. Administered prices by governments don't move up very quickly and they're not very sensitive. They can move in discrete amounts every few months. But the sensitive elements, currencies and commodities, will begin to reflect it. Now, the next thing that we have to consider is where will the next bubble be? And it's possible that the next bubble will be in things like commodities, in particular in thinking something like gold. It's not likely to be the same thing that we just recently witnessed, because it's still fresh in people's minds that real estate is not a good investment anymore. So for the next few years, probably real estate will not necessarily be a great participant in the coming bubble. The technology bubble is getting a little older. It's receding. So maybe that will come back. You know, the The market tends to move in directions that have a lot have to do with psychology, and a lot has to do with the sensitivity of the and the liquidity also of the instruments. Foreign exchange is very liquid. Commodities are very liquid. They're easy to buy in credit, and they're probably going to be the first indicators of the coming inflation problem.
Al, I think of all the shocking events that have occurred in this very dramatic past 6 weeks, none has surpassed the strength of the dollar as a surprise element. I don't know, I can't think of a single commentator who predicted that the dollar would get as strong as it did, as quickly as it did. What's your take on it, and how do you see it playing out?
Okay, a couple of points. First, currencies is a relative game. It's not an absolute game. So it's hard to say that you are very bearish about a currency in absolute terms. You can say, because you have to measure against something else. And so, assuming that you felt that the U.S. was doing everything wrong, and it was on an inflation rate path, and on a path that would preclude growth, let's say, you still cannot make a judgment about the U.S. dollar without relating it first to against what. So, if the European economies are doing the same thing, then the dollar will not necessarily move lower. The dollar-euro ratio will be roughly similar because they're both doing the same. So it's very important that when we look at currencies, to look at them in relative terms. And relative to the world, 6 months ago, the U.S. dollar was extremely cheap. This is something that we wrote in our quarterlies, and I think it was in relation to our fixed income program, where we had some people asking, why aren't you invested in foreign currency bonds? You do better with foreign currency bonds because the dollar was falling. And my answer was, in the relative terms, the U.S. dollar was actually very cheap. It was at the bottom of its range in real terms, adjusted by inflation. It was at the bottom of its range for the past 30 years. And that, even given that foreign exchange is a relative game, it didn't pay really to switch out of U.S. dollars. Now, I did not know, and if I would have known, I would have, of course, made a lot of money, but I didn't know that the dollar would turn so quickly, but it did, and I'll explain what caused it to turn, at least in retrospect, but it was clear that it was in a very cheap range, it was what would you call undervalued in some way. Now, what made the dollar, what was the catalyst for the dollar to get out of that undervaluation zone? And it was simply the fact that the dollar, number one, was being used as a funding currency for investments abroad. The largest amount of investments in emerging markets was coming out of the United States via funds and via all kinds of hedge funds and all kinds of mutual funds that were designed to buy emerging markets. So a lot of dollars went abroad to take advantage of that. A lot of dollars were used as funding to, let's say, buy positions in high-yielding currencies like the Brazilian real, like the Turkish lira. And so when things started getting a little shakier, money started coming back. People were beginning to worry about their investments in emerging markets and about their carry trades. And the dollar, which had been one of the carry trades, not the best, but one of them, but certainly the largest one, benefited from the reflows back. And very quickly, the dollar was bid. And it was bid from, went all the way from 160 to 125, let's say, against the euro. That, by the way, is a range. In floating exchange rates, you don't have a precise number. What is exactly the value? You have imprecise, indeterminate ranges. And so the range probably is a maybe 25, 30 cent range. And maybe the range exchange should be somewhere between 120 and 150, and so the dollar is now trading back to the top part of the range against the euro. So the dollar move is not illogical. Interestingly, the other funding currency, the other large funding currency, was the yen. And the yen was used almost by everybody to fund positions in New Zealand, in Australia, all over the world, in Europe. And of course, again, when the economy around the world started getting a little shakier and people started feeling a little more uncomfortable, what they did was liquidate those positions and repatriate the money. In other words, get rid of the Australian dollar and repay the yen. Well, that caused the yen to rise and the Australian dollar to go down. And we saw what happened. There was a collapse in the Australian dollar. There was a collapse in the New Zealand dollar. These are moves that are associated with waves of speculation, waves of entering and getting out of positions, right?
You imply that the dollar is now towards the lower end of the range. Is that so?
No, the dollar is towards its own upper range right now. It's moving it towards its own upper range, meaning that the dollar has moved out of its undervaluation zone.
Sorry, right.
It's gone now into what you call fully valued zone. I would think that now it's about fully valued, at least vis-a-vis the main currencies. So vis-a-vis the main currencies. I'm not making that judgment as all the other ones, but vis-a-vis the main currencies.
Okay. And what about the yen? Would you make the same case with the yen? Is there a range with the yen? And is the yen now towards the upper reach of that range?
The yen is a strange phenomenon because the yen move was extremely artificial. Again, the yen was starting from a very cheap zone, very, very cheap zone, because it was being used as a funding currency. It was pushed down to extraordinarily low levels. It's now coming back to a far more value. I'm not sure if the yen at the moment is fully valued or is getting close to that, but there's no doubt in my mind that somewhere between 80 and 110 is a zone for a proper valuation of the yen. Now, the yen has a disadvantage. It doesn't have a dynamic. The Japanese doesn't have a dynamic economy. It's almost like an old man's economy. So it's a very old economy. It doesn't have vibrancy. It doesn't have flexibility. It's trapped in some old man behavior type thing. So I don't think that the yen is the kind of currency that will do. For instance, it's not like the Chinese yuan. The Chinese economy is vibrant. It's strong. It's with all its impediments, with all the controls that exist, the Chinese economy can still grow enormously. You can see the day that the yuan, instead of trading at 685 or 680 today, could be trading at 3 or 2. I mean, it's not possible to think that way about the yen. The yen was a trading vehicle. The yen is a trading vehicle by all these traders in foreign exchange markets. They used it to fund things, and now they're getting out of it. So, and the dollar, which was used as a funding vehicle, too, has its own merits. We just hope that we don't lose some of the vibrancy in the next few years with bad policies. But the dollar could move into not only an overvalued range, but it could move into a new range altogether vis-a-vis the rest of the world. I don't think that we can say the same thing about the yen.
Okay, I'm going to, just before we get to the public question part, I'll put to you two questions in the form of two words. One is gold, and the second is Canadian dollar. A lot of our listeners are invested one way or another in both. Do you have a comment on either or both of them, please?
Okay, first gold. first, let me say that I was rather surprised and caught off guard by the very large move down that gold had. I didn't expect it to go below maybe 850, 825, 850. I certainly didn't think it would go below 825. The move down to 680 was kind of shocking to me. On the other hand, I took some solace, some comfort at the fact that gold denominated in euros and Canadian dollars in other commodities in oil terms did extremely well. And has been doing well. Has been relatively much stronger than commodities in general, and stronger than most currencies around the world. And that probably a lot of the selling had to do with the U.S. dollar strength. And maybe there were too many speculative positions in this market, and as a result, the market sold off more than it should have done. Going forward. I mentioned before that currencies, foreign exchange is a relative game, and I said that if the U.S. inflates a great deal and Europe inflates too, then the dollar is not likely to go down very much against the euro because they're both inflating. But there is something that can move against both of those currencies, and at the moment the gold is moving against almost every other currency in the world except the dollar. And I believe that if the U.S. inflates, as they continue to inflate, as they're doing now, and the rest of the world does too, that gold will be the prime, maybe the prime beneficiary of that inflation. Furthermore, I think that Asian central banks, I've been making this case for now some time, Asian central banks have very, very little gold holdings, and when they look at the gold holdings of European countries, where Europe, even the United States, where gold represents 30 to 50% of their international reserves, I think will at some point in time really feel that they too need to add to their gold holdings, starting from almost zero, building up a position to even 25% for China, for Taiwan, for even for India, for many of these countries will represent an enormous buying power in this market. It's hard for me to even conceive that they can. It's hard for me even to imagine what would happen to prices if say the Chinese decided to up their reserves from practically zero to 10%. They have at the moment almost $2 trillion of reserves. So, 20% of that, $400 billion, to try to put $400 billion to work in a gold market, it's going to be a little bit hard. But I believe it will happen. I believe it will happen, and I believe that it will make for very powerful support to this move. It will make for very powerful. There will be a lot of powerful factors operating this market on the upside. One of them is central banks, and the other one is just simply individuals who will begin to feel that the inflationary policies around the world are causing problems. So I see a very bright future for gold from these levels. Canadian dollar. In truth, I totally missed the move all the way up to 110, 10% premium to the U.S. I think it was mostly driven by this enthusiasm for commodities, especially oil. So it had to do with improving terms of trade. Canada and Australia and New Zealand, all three of these countries enjoyed a great improvement in the terms of trade. And now that those terms of trade are coming back down to earth, now that they're turning down, this is what happens to these currencies. So the Australian has come down, the New Zealand has come down, the Canadian has come down dramatically. So will they recover? It will probably recover when commodity prices do a little bit better. When will that happen? I don't know. But I'd say the Canadian dollar is certainly now much value zone rather than it was before. And I think that its value zone is going to be somewhere between 75 and 85 cents.
Thank you. Okay, let's give ourselves 10 or 15 minutes if we can to ask and answer a couple of questions. Here's one from an esteemed client. I'm going to read it to you. Credit derivatives positions could have large gains in value. How do you gauge the risk that either counterparty failure or an overall system breakdown with general abrogation of contracts could prevent these gains from being realized?
That's a big problem. That's a big problem. Counterparty risk was one of the main reasons why we liquidated closed many positions early, and in fact liquidated many positions early because we were afraid of counterparty risk. It was like walking in a minefield. And I'm sorry that I did some of those because, you know, we would have cashed, we would have done much better had we kept most of these positions. It appears that they're being paid. Lehman failed. Yet those CDSs seem to be settling. The Lehman CDSs themselves are settling, but the question is, what about the position that funds, for instance, had with Lehman? And I'm not sure that there's been any problems. I've not heard any problems yet. But I do think that credit derivatives. I do believe that credit derivatives are problematic because they're not traded in an exchange, and I believe that the next important thing to do is to get these things moved on to an exchange where we're going to get transparency, a lot of transparency, where we're going to get clearing houses guaranteeing the transaction. So they're a valuable instrument. They're a very valuable instrument, in fact, but they need to be. By the way, I don't like to use the word regulated. I'm not one of those who believes in regulation, but I believe a lot in transparency. And I think that if we had them traded in an exchange, it would be a formidable instrument. So I'm looking forward to the exchanges bringing on the CDSs onto their markets.
Thank you. And then a number of questions concerning deleveraging. Deleveraging, restraining the multiplier effect of money supply growth. Deleveraging overwhelming money supply growth. Deleveraging coming as a result of hedge fund liquidation, overwhelming security values. To what extent do you think the deleveraging has been discounted or factored in to current equity values and commodity values?
To quote, not quote verbatim, but to paraphrase my good friend Steve Anke, who was describing the other day the leveraging business and the deleveraging business. He had an apt metaphor. He said, "Look, you got to look at this as levels. There is like a pyramid, and at the bottom, at the very peak of the pyramid, you have the banking system, and the banking system and its credit, the credit that it issues. But then you have a much broader activity beyond the banking system, where you have intermediaries now." Mediating with credit, and that is a lot greater than the banking leverage. I mean, just to give you some numbers, ideas and numbers, if you look at the flow of funds, about $1 trillion is produced by the banking system in loans, but $4 trillion were produced in the last few months by the above banking system world. But it's like two or three worlds here we're dealing with. And the bottom level, which is really it's almost a peak in the pyramid, but the bottom level, which the banking level, is safe. We now know it's safe. The regulators, the government, the Federal Reserve have now made sure that the banking system is safe and that bank credit will be protected because capital is being protected. Will it increase? Probably not for a while. But where the deleveraging is taking place is above that, at the level above that. And that's GDI growth, it does to some extent and for some period, for some time. I think that deleveraging is affecting and will continue to affect markets and anything that gets bought and sold like real estate on credit. It will be affected, but in the longer run, it's money that it's money rather than credit in the long run that makes the difference. And so, and I think that money right now is being protected, and it's being and we're making sure that at least the U.S. government is making sure that money will continue to expand, will continue to grow, will not allow it to contract. So deleveraging is having some very negative effects right now, just like it had very positive effects on the way up. I mean, it wasn't the banking system that so much that helped the boom along, but it was the upper level of credit creation that created the boom. And so now that's collapsing, that's contracting, so that's having its effect on the credit markets. But once that's over, as long as money supply, the integrity of money supply is protected, I believe that we are into an inflationary path.
We've got time for one more. We have a visitor asking us about if there's a particular sector that we like in equities. And before I put that to you, I'll just take the opportunity to point out to those of us, to those listeners who don't know, that the equity market neutral pocket of the Global Macro Hedge Fund is a very opportunistic pocket in which we're looking to capture values on both sides of the market. We are looking to buy overvalued, to short overvalued companies and to buy undervalued companies, and that our decisions are largely sector-based. So the question of is there as the market finds a bottom or gropes for a bottom and looks to advance from here, are there particular sectors that you see outperforming going forward?
Okay, just in very broad strokes, I like the large U.S. blue chips, the Johnson & Johnson's, McDonald's, IBM's, even Exxon, Triple M. These are large companies. They have good balance sheets, very good balance sheets. They have a global footprint, and they should do well. I mean, they've come down a great deal, and they should do well. I don't think that the financial sector will regain its previous reattain its previous heights. I think that there's been too much dilution in this market, and shareholder dilution. You know, Citicorp has sold so much stock, and UBS, and all the large. I think they are safe. They won't go under, but are they going to make the earnings per share that we were used to in the past? No, they're not likely to do that. Their capitalization has increased too much. Goldman Sachs has not only diluted its Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley not only diluted their shareholdings, but have now also come under much stricter regulation. They've become banks, and they're not likely to have the leverage that they used to have before. So I think that generally the financial sector is not the place to be. Another place to be to capitalize on the coming market move, coming market upside move. The safest bets are the large U.S. Blue chips. A very intriguing area, and one in which we just started doing a little bit of buying, is the gold stock area. We see today some of the better companies, the better gold mining companies, trading at levels that reflect maybe $300 an ounce gold. If you look at the prices today of Barrick and Newmont, as an example, they're trading at the same levels as they were trading when gold was trading at $300 an ounce. And that is, I think, absurd. I understand that there is some reason why they don't merit the very high prices that they had back a year ago, that's because the emergence of ETFs has made gold stocks less attractive. You know, you can buy their gold directly. But at some point, these gold mining companies should be treated as businesses. And with gold at these prices, they're making money. And as long as they can replace reserves, which that too is a bit of a question mark, as long as they can replace reserves, they should be treated as businesses, and they should, and they're cheap. They're very cheap. So, there's, you know, it's kind of difficult now to say what will do well, what won't do well. I mean, there are some areas that have been bumped out, like casino stocks. And certainly when the economy turns, inflation will make these, again, good businesses.